So, Catherine, what is the protest in Hong Kong about and what is the protest criticizing?
The demand of the whole movement was relatively simple in the very beginning, which is withdrawal of the bill, a bill which enabled the extradition of suspects to mainland China. But following the Hong Kong government's refusal to withdraw the bill and increasingly violent suppression by the police, in late June last year, the protesters' focus and aims have shifted and coalescing into the five demands. And the protesters are not only asking for a complete withdrawal of the bill, but also police accountability, amnesty for the arrested protesters, as well as a broader political reform. And meanwhile, the protests have extended to various locations throughout Hong Kong, moving from the financial and political centers to more peripheral communities. And moreover, protesters have shifted their tactics, complementing the mass demonstrations with more radical tactics, including raiding into government buildings, road and metro blocking, and on the other hand, the battlefield has also expanded beyond the street conflicts. The protesters have been exploring the possibilities of polarizing the economy on weekdays, shutting down the airport, and also gaining more seats in the district level elections. And then there's a change in last November when the two battles taken place in two universities. And at that time, the police arrested over 1,000 people in a single day. And after that, a very painful and high cost of protest led to a decline in the radical street protest paradigm. And we can see more growth in other fronts of the society, like unions, yellow economic circles, and communities. And in late 2019, we also see a landslide victory in the legislation council and a new wave of union registration. But so far and until that time, the five demands haven't been changed, but also we could see their more radical slogans like Free Hong Kong, Revolution of Our Times, and or Abolish Police Force. And also, like in late 2019, there are more and more demands and voices from the protesters about Hong Kong's independence.
You already mentioned a few strategies the movement is using. We continue talking about that topic. The protests in Hong Kong are well known for their protest tactics and, for example, their flexibility. And the Hong Kong protests also inspired strategies that are used by the Black movement, for example. What's so special about the techniques and the tactics and strategies the protest is using in Hong Kong?
From my point of view, I think the most inspiring part is the distributed nature of the movement, which means it's the opposite of centralized or a movement with leading organizations or political stars. So basically, people realize that the negotiation with the government is not going to work, and we shouldn't trust the state at all, so that there are a lot of direct actions being organized. And we also see a lot of mutual aid networks have been formed. And because of all these distributed and decentralized concepts shared by the protesters, there are a lot of strategies developed based on this concept. So, for example, when the protesters didn't know where are the police, there will be people doing the life map of the police locations. And there will be scouts to report back the location of the police and mark it on the life map. Or when there are a lot of protesters being injured on the street and cannot go to hospital, there will be voluntary doctors to take care of them. Or when there are some young protesters given by financial aid by their parents, there will be adoptive parents who take care of where to live and to give food to them. So I would say because there's no leaders in this movement, so protesters turn out to have more ownership. And then they observe the needs of movement at the moment and trying their best to contribute their strength proactively.
The German media often depicts the protest movement in Hong Kong as a really unified bloc, but just from my experience here with protests in Germany, I know that is never the case. So can you give us an overview of different wings of the movement and how much influence they have in each case?
This is a very good question, but also a very difficult one to answer. Considering how broad and diverse participation is, it has been really difficult to generalize the dynamic of different political ideologies. And I would even argue that the traditional left and right wing political spectrum is not that valid here. And since near early 2000, there has been more discussions or protests or strikes that is critical to capitalism in Hong Kong, but it's still not a strong force in the society. And after the so-called failure of the Umbrella Movement in 2014, the left-wing activists are the target being blamed for the failure of the movement. And in the following years after Umbrella Movement, there's an emerging wave of right-wing localists who have been trying to promote the anti-immigrants and local first agenda. However, and the movement in 2019, this time movement is so big that no certain kinds of political agenda can really dominate the movement. So it's interesting to see, actually, a lot of these people are not politically developed, but they have lots of commitment and direct actions. And a lot of them are triggered by the police brutality and join the protesters for the first time in their life. So that's also the reason why we might not see a really coherent political agenda or be able to categorize them in a particular ideology.
And does the movement in Hong Kong have ties to the oppositional groups in mainland China, for example, the workers' movement in China?
Unfortunately, it's a no. But I think the important reason is because the Beijing government has launched national security law in mainland back in 2015. This has posed lots of obstacles on the exchanges or solidarity actions between mainland and Hong Kong activists. So I think in the long run, it's more like the civil society in mainland China and in Hong Kong would get more and more isolated. It's just the fear that the government posed this law with the intention to isolate activists and different networks in the society so that it could be more difficult for them to fight back. And in response to this, I think what the civil society should do is actually building more connections. And it would be really important for, let's say, the social networks in Hong Kong to reach out to the NGOs or activists in mainland China to learn about what they have going through and what was their strategies and what is the lessons we could learn.
On 20th of June, the security law was imposed on Hong Kong by the Chinese government. But why did China pass the security law and what is their interest in Hong Kong?
So I would see this new law as a response to the whole movement last year. Because in the whole movement last year, the movement basically touched all parts of the society. And this is a ruthless and strong gesture saying they're going to crack all these down. And if we have a look at the national security law, basically they could punish crimes of sedition, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign force with up to life in prison. So because the law was just imported, and in the past week, we see people who were arrested, suspected of violating national security law for just showing a slogan of Free Hong Kong Revolution of Times or Hong Kong Independence. So this is quite scary that they have been using the law to prosecute people for just doing nothing. So it's worth mentioning how the law was introduced. So basically at 11 p.m. in the evening of June 30th, the law was finally being uploaded to the website. And only 1 hour later, that is July 1st, it has become like implemented and started to arrest people under that. The most scary thing is that the manner they're issuing this law basically shows they don't bother to explain what is the law to Hong Kong people. And before that, nobody saw the law. Not to say the civil society, but also the chief executive herself or other politicians who are, have been saying, oh, please support the law is good, without even reading it. So this is like a really ridiculous part of it.
Yeah, could you give us more information on that and how the law during the last week changed Hong Kong and also the movement?
It's worth mentioning that even after the introduction of national security law, people in Hong Kong didn't give up fighting. On July 1st, the first day the law came effective, people still managed to organize a protest against the law despite the no objection notice issued by the police. On that day, riot police with full gears occupied every intersection on Island Side from Kaohsiung Bay to Central, but tens of thousands of people still turned out on the street. They walked out to block the car road and chanted the slogans when the police was away temporarily. And they walked back to the pavement and pretended to be passersby when the police is back. It was like a hit-and-run urban guerrilla, but you can tell like people try very hard not to be silenced and struggle to fight even though the cost they could have paid was really high. On the other hand, people also try to play around the censorship in their daily lives. For example, there were people holding blank papers during the protests, and some people even wrote Mao's quote about revolutions on the posit. All the crimes are just very vaguely defined, so which means it's easy for people to be worried about it and start to censor themselves. And we could see that in the past days. For example, there are more and more restaurants started to pull off the posters that is pro-movement from their shops. And it started on the next day of the implementation because couple of police raided into a restaurant and people started to delete their social media accounts or change their names and then have more concerns to talk in public. There were college principals issue a letter, a mass email to its students saying like, if you're not following the national security law, then you might be expelled. So this is really suffocating now at this moment, like in Hong Kong society.
And now our last question, do you think the current development in Hong Kong might affect the politics of the Chinese government also in connection to Taiwan and the South China Sea?
I think, first of all, Hong Kong struggle is really revealing. And in a way, it's a really important lesson for Taiwan people to see, an example of one country, two system, like how it will look like. So basically, because of the struggle in Hong Kong, I think now there are not many Taiwanese people still have the false faith that it would be a good idea if we got unification. And actually, the whole Hong Kong struggle has been helping out the election for Democratic Progressive Party. And we see a lot of Hong Kong people become political refugees in Taiwan. And we see solidarity rallies in Taiwan in support of the struggles in Hong Kong. So we see more and more exchange and connections in civil society between Hong Kong and Taiwan. But also because of this suppression from the Chinese government in Hong Kong, I think there's also a really emerging hostile sentiments towards mainland Chinese people in Taiwan. And that is manifested in how Taiwanese government has been dealing with the immigrants and their border control with mainland China.